Welcome back to the Business of Government Magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. It is a leadership imperative for government executives to mitigate the potency of uncertainty by managing the realities of risk. Employing an enterprise risk management process can assist leaders in doing just that. This forum presents government leaders with insights, recommendations, and best practices drawn from two recent IBM Center reports that focus on managing risk in government. The first contribution to this forum comes from Doug Webster and Tom Stanton and their report for the IBM Center, Improving Government Decision-Making Through Enterprise Risk Management. There are various definitions of risk. So what is risk, and why is risk so often viewed in negative terms? And when can risk also refer to positive action? Here's Doug Webster.
Well, probably the most direct answer to that is that risk, if you look it up in the dictionary, is almost always couched in negative terms. So it's a threat, some vulnerability, and so on. And as a result, folks involved in risk management tend to look at, or not necessarily those only involved in risk management, but people that are impacted by risk management look at it in those terms. However, that's a very narrow context because you also need to consider what's the trade-offs, what's the rewards for going after various risks. And so ISO 31000, International Standard on Risk Management, defines risk as the uncertainty of objectives. Now, that is a different definition of risk, but that having been said, it's not consistent with the other definition if for the other definition you also include what are the risks and the rewards. The point is that both of those need to be considered jointly.
Doug Webster highlights some of the most compelling reasons why the federal government should be adopting and is adopting enterprise risk management.
Well, to the degree that the federal government is already involved in risk management, and I would suggest every organization is involved in risk management in some fashion, it has traditionally and typically been within various functional stovepipes. So, for example, the chief financial officer certainly worries about getting a clean audit opinion. The CIO worries about cybersecurity, et cetera. However, when you manage risks within these functional silos and you don't come together collectively, you don't have an ability to prioritize at the overall enterprise level across those functional stovepipes. Moreover, you don't have the ability to identify cross-functional impacts where the CIO, for example, mitigating one risk may be creating unknowingly risks in other parts of the organization. You don't have the ability to prioritize resources across all of those. And finally, you are unable to develop that portfolio view of risk across the enterprise to ensure it's consistent with a risk appetite for that organization.
Webster also defines for us enterprise risk management.
I think that's an extremely important question because one of the big frustrations I have is enterprise risk management these days is a term that's thrown out there very loosely and very poorly understood by so many people who use that term. And that doesn't restrict itself only to those in the federal government where the term is newer than it is in the private sector, but also in the private sector. I've talked to folks within the risk management profession that don't understand and who use the term enterprise risk management and really don't understand the principles. Because for many people, enterprise risk management is simply glorified risk management, meaning it's still conducted within functional silos and it's done really well, but they have not taken that next step to try and integrate those across those silos. In some cases, it's the term is used when what they're really talking about is internal controls. And enterprise risk management and risk management in general, for that matter, is much broader than simply internal controls. So the metaphor that I like to use because it works for me is the fact that if you had all the various functional stovepipes, whether it belonging to a functional head like a CIO, a CFO, so on, or a bureau level head or a program office, represented by a brick, the metaphor I use is a pile of bricks is not equal to a brick wall. ERM takes what you have in risk management today, and hopefully you've got a complete set of processes that are focused functionally, programmatically, et cetera, but then takes it a further step and brings the mortar, if you will, to those bricks to turn into a brick wall, to generate a portfolio view. Without that, you're really not talking about enterprise risk management. You're simply talking about traditional risk management.
Tom Stanton underscores the value of risk management and explains how the effective use of risk management strategies can improve senior leadership decision-making and act as a tool to strengthen it.
Well, the whole point of risk management, enterprise risk management in particular, is that decision-makers consider both the rewards and the risks of any decision. In my view, One of the important functions of enterprise risk management is to ensure the flow of communications to the decision maker. They need to have the information that is directly relevant to the decision they want to make. And that means communications up and down the hierarchy, also across the silos, to bring the powerful business unit heads into the conversation, to be sure the decision maker knows everything that they need to know.
In improving government decision-making through enterprise risk management, Webster and Stanton describe six challenges facing government leaders and six steps that government leaders can take to successfully implement enterprise risk management. You can download a free copy of this report at businessofgovernment.org. There are approximately 75 days between presidential election and the inauguration of a new president. This is considered the presidential transition period. It is a time of opportunity and hazards for an incoming administration. The transition from campaigning to governing requires that presidential policies be transformed from rhetoric into an actionable agenda and then into concrete results. Martha Kumar, author of Before the Oath, How George W. Bush and Barack Obama Managed a Transfer of Power, joined me on the Business of Government Hour to discuss her latest book on presidential transitions.
There's not a long history to it of a formal transition. The first one where a president really thought out beforehand when he knew he wasn't going to be running for re-election, and it was important to him, the quality of the information he left behind, was Truman. Truman wanted to make certain whoever his successor would be would not be left in the same situation he was when he became president on the death of Franklin Roosevelt, because he had been in as vice president a short period of time, coming in January 20th, and then in early April, Franklin Roosevelt died and Truman became president. And he found that there was a great deal that he didn't know about what was going on in government, particularly relating to the war. And the biggest item was the development of the atomic bomb, and he had been unaware of that. So what he did is he wrote both Adlai Stevenson and General Eisenhower about coming into the White House. And let me read to you the exchange, because in a way it's important in this transition, this past 2008 transition, because I think what had happened, what Truman tried to bring about, bringing the candidates in early, happened in 2008, but it happened in a different way. It was the representatives were brought in early. So in a way, it kind of closed that circle of what Truman had tried to do. So on August 13th, 1952, the president wrote to the candidates, "I'll have General Walter Bedell Smith and the Central Intelligence Agency give you a complete briefing on foreign situation." Eisenhower wrote in response, "In my current position as standard bearer of the Republican Party and of other Americans who want to bring about a change in the national government, it's my duty to remain free to analyze publicly the policies and acts of the present administration whenever it appears to me to be proper and in the country's interest. I believe our communications should be only those which are known to all the American people. Consequently, I think it would be unwise and result in confusion with the public mind if I were to attend the meeting in the White House to which you have invited me." And Truman was not happy. No, he wasn't. And you know that his response was going to be pretty strong. It was a handwritten response, and those he could mail when he was passing a mailbox on his morning walks. "I'm extremely sorry that you have allowed a bunch of screwballs to come between us. You have made a bad mistake, and I'm hoping it won't injure this great republic." Wow. But what he wanted to do was make sure that both candidates were well informed. But the politics at the time didn't call for it. Today, the situation is different. And in 2008, Josh Bolton, who was the chief of staff and in charge of the transition operations for President Bush, had representatives of both the Obama and McCain campaigns come into the White House and work on several different items that were going to be important to get straight before a new president took office. So they really thought through getting things in order and coming into the White House.
What factors contributed to the increase in importance of presidential transitions? Here's Martha Kumar.
I think there's an increase in the importance of the presidency. Okay. And the president is a world leader, and the sense of time, that you just don't have time. You want to be knowledgeable when you come into office. And others in the political system and the public want that as well. Mm-hmm. And I think in 2008, one of the big factors were the attacks on the United States on September 11th, and a lot flowed from that. Congress passed legislation that the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act allowed for early security clearances for people coming in to work on a transition. And those were important because these security clearances take a while. And now you have so many people that are working on a transition, and then many of them will go into the government itself in other positions. So you want to get that done as early as you can. And the administration made sure that that happened.
Kumar describes the characteristics of a well-prepared, successful transition.
The 2008-09 transition was a particularly good one because both sides took very seriously. I think one of the factors involved in a good transition is that the president himself is involved and that the president directs the transition. And the kind of work that you need to do requires long lead time. And so he talked to Josh Bolton in December of 2007 about the transition and told him that with two wars, it was really important to have the best transition ever. Most presidents will say they want to have the best transition ever, but the question is when they say it. Mm-hmm. Saying it in December of 2007 is a lot different than saying it the November of the presidential election, when you don't have time to do very much. So with that charge, then Bolton was able to plan out what kinds of things needed to be done and getting a head start on it. And at each point, trying to get in early.
It is critically important for presidential candidates to engage in early transition planning. Martha Kumar elaborates.
For a sitting administration, early means that you can start as, say, Steve Hadley did in late 2007 to prepare the information on the memoranda, the national security memoranda. And I think one of the things that the Bush administration did, too, is they laid out how important they thought that planning for transition was. Clay Johnson, who was the deputy for management at the Office of Management and Budget and had been executive director of George Bush's transition into office, he said that it was irresponsible not to be planning early. And so they tried to set that stage to help the candidates, so that the hubris argument would not really be something that was important to people. And I think people understand that you really do have to have planning. And but on the other hand, you know, candidates are reluctant because they don't want to look as if they're assuming that they're going to win. But early planning is important even for the campaign, because if you can think through what your goals are, put your campaign goals together in relationship to what your priorities are going to be governing, that really is very useful.
In Washington, D.C., policy formation tends to get much of the focus, with management and implementation taking a back seat. What can be done to put management and management-related issues on a higher station. Here's Martha Kumar.
With Republicans, it tends to have be more of a priority than it is with Democrats. But I think in this administration, one of the things that happened was even if they had had a strong management agenda, that they had to deal with the financial crisis. And that was just crucial. I think generally it's just it is so crucial to everything you do. But people often work on a calendar of you know what's happening next week, what's happening next month, and not thinking about how they're going to implement all of it.
Next up, insights from leaders when the special edition of the Business of Government magazine returns.